at whether the U.S. lack of political unity, and also will, on going ahead with an agreement may prevent a deal from happening. This, as Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said, that the main obstacle in the way of talks in Vienna is the U.S. administration's pursuit of the failed policies of his predecessor. Let's find out the latest on the talks that are going on in Vienna. Our correspondent Homa Leski joins us. Homa, at this point, a couple of days have passed, second day almost over. What has transpired in terms of any movement forward?
Yes, Carver. So as this eighth round of the Vienna talks resume, already, as you say, discussions have begun, and the head of Iran's delegation has met the EU coordinator, Enrico Mora, twice. He's also met with the three European countries, the Russians and the Chinese, in separate meetings. And we're hearing that these meetings are focusing now on the few remaining issues. Although they are few, they are quite critical and key to reaching a successful outcome. The Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, just tweeted recently saying that he's also held a meeting with the EU coordinator and that they both agreed on the need to intensify talks, in his words, and look for creative ways and means to settle the remaining outstanding issues. What are they? As we've said before, they include on the sanctions front, verification and guarantees. How can Iran be assured that the U.S., the next president, the next administration, even this administration, does not change tack and does not withdraw from the deal again, does not reimpose sanctions? And also, how can the sanctions removal be verified before Iran takes action? The issue of sequencing or implementation, that's why, is also one of the key issues that's still being discussed. We know, of course, if the talks here in Vienna reach a conclusion and the sides announce that they've to agree on a final draft, which would be the revised or revived the JCPOA, this doesn't mean that exactly then we'll see implementation. We're hearing that there will be a preparation period taking for as long as maybe a few weeks or to 1 or 2 months or even more. And that preparation period is where verification comes in, where we will see actions that needed to be taken, especially as far as Iran is concerned, by the Americans, in order for Iran to be assured that now it can take the steps and put the restrictions that were in place before when it comes to its nuclear commitments. Something else that we're hearing is that Iran says it's not going to back down on its research and development when it comes to its nuclear commitments. The issue of Iran's nuclear measures is also mentioned among the remaining outstanding issues. And Iran says that it will go as far as the JCPOA obligations go, but that doesn't mean that it will step away from the research and development that it's done in this period following the withdrawal of the Trump administration, and it wants to be able to continue to do that. Now, just the major question that you asked there, and I'll just quickly add this, are we going to see a success in these talks or not? There is still voices of hope coming from Joseph Borrell, as I said earlier. He said he believes and he hopes that there will be a successful conclusion. But what we're also hearing is, especially from the Iranians, if the Americans do make the important political decisions, as far as the expert-level talks are concerned and the drafting is concerned, everything has been done. Now it's up to the important decisions to be made. If they make that decision, despite, of course, the pressure that the Biden administration is now facing from Republicans in the Senate and Congress, then this is going to be possible. We'll have to see if that's going to happen.
Thank you very much for that. Homa Leski there from Vienna. Many thanks. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. Also joining us, historian, political analyst, and author Marcus Papadopoulos, who's joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Vlasha Magnier, let me first start with you. Welcome. We're looking at these talks to have restarted on Tuesday. And at the same time, we're seeing an uptick, an increase of noise, as one can call it, coming from the U.S. And I'm going to start with a couple Democrats, lawmaker Bob Menendez, saying that he opposes the deal, and also him by joining the senior member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Chuck Schumer, rejecting the proposition of this deal. Why do you think we're seeing that happen at this stage in the game? And what does that mean, really?
Well, it means that President Biden, he has a domestic uncertainty over the nuclear deal. If there is a new nuclear deal on the table and not the re-implementation of the same deal. So in case it is exactly the same deal as signed in 2015, then there is no need to go back to the Congress and have the approval of the Senate. However, if there are changes within the deal, then there is a need of a Congress approval. The Senates are trying to warn Biden to say that unless you give us a deal and we're happy with it, then we're not going to approve it. However, we saw the letter forwarded today by the Republican that includes only 33 signatures. That means that the Republicans are still very low in number to be able to affect President Biden, who can disregard that request. Nonetheless, that proves that Iran has a right to ask for verification and to make sure that there is no new president that's going to take over in 2025 and again throw out the deal. This is what Iran has been negotiating due to the experience of Donald Trump, who did that in 2018. So it is up to the United States to prove that they can respect their signature and they can abide by their promises. Otherwise, there is no point in signing a deal with a country like the United States that hasn't sought out its internal cuisine first before going to Vienna and negotiate in the presence of Russia, China, and its European partners.
Well, why didn't that happen, Marcus Papadopoulos? I'm sure Biden is aware of the lawmakers who are opposed to this. And the latest one, as our guest there, Elijah Magnier, pointed out to, are the 33 U.S. Republican lawmakers led by Senator Ted Cruz, that they're going to thwart. Basically, they said they're going to thwart any agreement if the terms were not submitted to Congress for approval, and that they will do everything in their power to block this possible deal if it moves forward without them. That sounds like a lot of Republicans that are against this. So where to now?
Well, it's a farcical state of affairs, and one which exemplifies how an American president is not truly in charge of the United States, and that is especially so when it comes to foreign policy making, because foreign policy making is ultimately decided by various machines within the American state, such as the military-industrial complex, special services, and lobby groups. But on the other hand, we have to view this in another light, namely, there are bitter divisions on Capitol Hill. Capitol Hill is extremely polarized, and the Republicans are taking this opportunity to try and derail the Biden presidency, because Joe Biden, who is utterly decrepit and utterly inept, has become one of the most unpopular American presidents in contemporary times. So the Republicans can sense blood, and this is an opportunity for them to cause more problems for Joe Biden leading up to the midterm elections, which will be this November. And of course, for Republicans, what better opportunity is before them to take than one concerning Iran? Because Iran, as we know, for 43 years has been vilified, has been dehumanized. So the Republicans see this as a golden opportunity to appeal to the American electorate by saying that only they are able to guarantee American national security and the security of their friends and the allies in the Middle East who are, in quotation marks, threatened by Iran. But even if Joe Biden was truly committed to the JCPOA, which he is not, after all, he is a self-professed Zionist, but even if he was, hypothetically speaking, and a new agreement was formulated, who on earth would trust America to remain a party to an agreement which it has signed up to? After all, the Americans have a long history, a checkered history,
right,
of either departing from treaties which it is a party to, or violating treaties which it is a party to, such as the ABM Treaty, the INF Treaty, both of which were with Russia, and of course the JCPOA, which America was a party to up until Donald Trump. So the Iranians simply cannot trust anything that comes from the Americans, either verbally or in writing.
Sure. Okay, before we continue, I'd like to make this bold, because this is something that Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has said. And this is just a general statement coming viewpoint in Iran, not only from Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, not only from the National Security Council, also coming from Iran's foreign minister, that the deal does not tie up Iran's economy. Iran's economy is not going to live or die by this deal. That's purely etched on the wall. The writing's on the wall there for that. But Elijah Magnier, I liked what Marcus Papadopoulos said when he said Republicans are smelling blood. At the same time, Iran is also smelling blood, and they are smelling blood in the respect where they know that there's got to be some steps taken, even if an agreement is reached, in order to see if this agreement actually works in reality. So you're looking at, for example, the verification process. Now tell us, even though Iran has the intention of doing that and will do it, when you have this many lawmakers, for example, the majority on the Republican side, going against this, don't you think then that they are going to do what they can to prevent, in general, companies from doing business with Iran, even though Iran is going to go through with that verification, which ultimately kind of shows that this deal is not going to happen in reality?
Well, I fully agree with every single word Marcus said. And what you are asking is a very good question and legitimate. We know, starting with Joe Biden, that he is not reliable, and he is so far committed to the sanctions imposed by Donald Trump. From the first beginning that he stepped in the White House, he kept these harsh sanctions on the Iranian population. The first obstacle, this, that he's not removing all sanctions to tell Iran that I have a good faith and I really want to move forward with the deal. So the only thing that he needs to do is to remove the sanctions, not keep them, not wait several months before starting to talk about the nuclear deal, and then just allow it to expand for more months and continue the negotiation without respecting the minimum, that is, abide by a deal that is already written in 2015 and that took several years to be negotiated. So there is no goodwill. The Americans are untrustworthy. President Biden is not better than Donald Trump, with the difference that Biden is looking more nicer in his approach, but in substance is doing exactly the same as Trump is doing. So Iran cannot accept a nuclear deal with not only without verification, but also there are other sanctions that the Americans can impose under different titles. This we've seen in the past. We've seen how Barack Obama did not respect the deal by signing it and then ordering all the banks around the world not to respect it. So I really agree with Marcus. Iran is dealing with an untrustworthy country that never respected its signature or its promises and has a long history in violating the international laws and just not being concerned about accountability. Therefore, there are no guarantees when signing a deal with the United States of America.
Okay, talk about guarantees here. That is something else, Marcus Papadopoulos, that Iran is looking for. Now, you have that be rejected outright. Not rejected, but saying that we cannot do that. And that came from who other than the U.S. Special Envoy Rob Malley. Now, Rob Malley, in a closed-door meeting with the Senate, is, I guess, giving the spiel on this, on the talks that are going on. Why isn't there a stance by Rob Malley taken to convince the lawmakers that there should be a guarantee given if the U.S. has goodwill in entering the revival talks in Vienna?
Well, ultimately, the aforementioned man is merely a voice box. He is merely the messenger from Washington, delivering in Vienna what Washington wants the Iranians and the other parties to know. So he holds no importance whatsoever. It's the people behind him. It's the people who are formulating America's approach to the JCPOA. And we have to recognize that the Americans are very savvy when it comes to public affairs. They understand all too well the need to be seen in public as doing something constructive vis-a-vis the JCPOA. In private, however, they are doing everything to sabotage the JCPOA, as they have been doing since Trump departed, since America under Trump departed from the agreement. And they are doing everything they possibly can in private to apportion blame for the JCPOA's problems on Iran, for example, by saying that the Iranians have not been fulfilling their obligations, which of course is a grotesque falsehood. And I'd like to make another point, which the other guest made a reference to. The imbeciles who comprise the woke movement in America hail Joe Biden as the great savior, as the great humanitarian, but they are utterly silent on how Biden has failed to rescind the vicious sanctions which Trump placed on Iran after America departed from the JCPOA. Those sanctions do not so much hurt the Iranian economy, more so they actually hurt ordinary Iranians. For example, they make it even more difficult for Iran to import hospital equipment and drugs for treating cancer patients in hospitals across Iran. So that is the true nature of Joe Biden. And that is but another reason why the Iranians are well within their rights to say they have no trust whatsoever in America, irrespective of who is sitting in the White House.
Right. Well, you make some great points there. And Elijah Magnier, one of the things that is very startlingly somewhat different, and it's taken a very positive twist and moving in a positive direction, is how Iran's 13th administration, headed by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi, is moving to enhance its relationship with regional countries. Saudi Arabia is part of that, the UAE, so forth and so on. So in that respect, the only entity left that perhaps says that Iran is going to work against it would be Israel. How can the U.S. prevent Israel from acting against Iran? Because that's one of the things, the reason I'm asking this is one of the things that Iran has actually requested, for it not to play a destructive role when it comes to the sanctions lifting talks and whatever provisions and agreements are made there.
I don't think the U.S. is trying to prevent Israel from attacking Iran. I think the Israelis want the Americans to start a war against Iran so they can participate, because they don't have the means to attack Iran and they fear the consequences. Who is defending Iran is Iran's advanced missile program and its capability and determination to impose deterrence on Israel and its allies that are spread in the Middle East. I don't think Iran relies on the Americans to stop Israel from attacking the Islamic Republic. I think the Iranians have made it very clear in many occasions when retaliating against the Israeli aggression, assassination, and piracy in the Gulf, that Iran is not going to wait for the Israeli to continue attacking the Iranian interest without retaliating, and by doing exactly what the Iranians should do, is to respond to every single Israeli aggression. And I think this is what is stopping Israel from attacking Iran. And the Americans know very well that they're not capable of starting a war in the Middle East against Iran when they've seen the consequences of the war in Afghanistan, who the Americans replaced Taliban after 20 years with the Taliban. And in 2003, they occupy Iraq, and they've got the result of ISIS that they have supported. In Syria, exactly the same. So all the wars they have started ended in disaster to the population of the Middle East, with no outcome or no interest or no positive result to the Americans. And they're not going to start a very destructive war against Iran, where everybody is going to hurt, mainly all the U.S. bases spread in the Middle East. And I think President Raisi made it clear. He gave his hand to the countries in the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Bahrain, and all the rest. And what they have done is they are trying to protect their ruling by joining the Israelis, because they have no willpower to sort out their own problems within the region, because they have a very fragile regime.
Well, that is a progress, I should say, the way that Iran's president and his administration are interacting at this point with, for example, Saudi Arabia or the UAE or even Bahrain, if there's any channels that have been opened up there. But, you know, we're quickly running out of time. You know, the thing with sanctions is obviously very high on the agenda here, and the removal of sanctions, Iran has requested that. But one thing that is not going to happen is the fact that we don't know what the future is going to bring. Iran has said that sanctions have to be such that they are not going to be reimposed under other pretexts like human rights or designations, so forth and so on. This is part of that unknown going into if there's going to be any revival to happen here from these talks. So what can then either side do in order to move forward here based on that? Marcus Papadopoulos.
Well, I agree with you. It is an unknown. I would add a dangerously unknown. But on the other hand, the Iranians intimately know the Americans. They intimately understand the mindset of Washington. After all, for 43 years now, America has been doing all within its powers, with the exception of going to war against Iran, to cripple the Iranian economy and thereby destroy the Iranian revolution. So the Iranians understand all too well that even though they cannot predict everything in the future, they do understand that the American objective of seeking to return Iran to how it was prior to the Iranian revolution, namely a satellite state of Washington's, remains intact. And the Americans, okay, as the Iranians know, will not rescind, sure, any of the sanctions they have imposed on Iran.
Thank you very much for that. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time. Marcus Papadopoulos there, historian, political analyst, and author. Thank you. And Elijah Magnier, thank you so much. From Brussels, journalist and political analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitakwe, entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the holy prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned.
معاد را همه قبول دارند.
The concept of Ma'ad, or the Day of Resurrection, is accepted by all religions. There is no single religion which does not believe in Ma'ad, or the Day of Resurrection. Whoever believes the source of creation also believes in the concept of Ma'ad. As we have in the narrations, we are born to be infinite, to be eternal. From this narration, we understand that death is only a different route for us, and life is continued through death. Here we find the concept of death very useful, because it is through death that we are transferred from this place to another place. In this way, death would be very sweet for us, because it is a new door to the other life. That's why the day and night of death are very much sweet for some people. It is like the day of wedding for them, sweet and pleasant. Such virtuous people look at death not as the final point, but as a starting point for the eternal life. They are happy because they want to go to the other world with the records of their good deeds. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Please do log into our website, which is parsetoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In recent days, a series of separate delegations from the EU have travelled to the United States, Ukraine and Russia as tensions between the West and Moscow show no sign of abating. The Kremlin insists the security of Russian citizens is paramount and therefore Ukraine cannot be allowed to join NATO. On Monday, the head of the 30-nation alliance confirmed additional NATO forces have been moved to Eastern Europe and there's a plan to make that permanent.
There is a process now going on within NATO, also, of course, in close consultation with our military commanders, to adjust our presence in the eastern part of the alliance.
Peace activists claim NATO is being unnecessarily provocative.
We would have a lot of advantages only with one symbolical sentence, not to expand with Ukraine and Georgia. And then Putin would be satisfied and you can make agreements with him.
The EU is sending huge amounts of money to Kiev.
More than 17 billion euros.
Even though the bloc's own agencies say Ukraine is corrupt at the highest levels, EU citizens are worried the situation could exacerbate the bloc's energy crisis, given that we import so much from Russia.
Putting in danger European gas supplies. So this is really frightening to me personally. And I think the whole European population should be frightened about this.
That could be a solution for the energy crisis. Everybody just spend less money on army and more money on compensation kind of energy support for the people.
A number of political commentators say some senior figures in the EU and NATO believe the West is pushing Russia a bit too far. Double standards and hypocrisy are at play, according to impartial foreign policy analysts.
They remind us the United States has approximately 800 military bases in 80 nations around the world. This as Russia is vilified for moving troops within its own borders. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahwaz is hosting one of the major oil shows in the country. The Ahwaz Oil Exhibition brought together 210 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are in the list of U.S. sanctions.
One of our major products is the two-phase flow pump, which is a vital piece in the oil exploration process. We used to be dependent on foreign supply of this equipment, and due to the sanctions, it was really hard to access it. So we decided to rely on our domestic expertise, and we now build two-phase pumps locally. We also specialize in the production and execution of all kinds of offshore oil rigs from A to Z.
For decades, Iran has relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But Washington's oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build this needed machinery, including drilling bits. And the result is beyond expectation.
Because of the sanctions, the oil industrial companies could not, you know, import these very important drilling rigs. So in these years, we made more than 300 drilling bits and PDC bits, and we made it, we manufactured it domestically. And we think that we can continue, manufacturing all of the needs of Iran.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 deal and the reimposition of sanctions the same year. Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs, down from 2.5 million. This prompted the country to rebuild its oil sector using its domestic know-how, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
Less than a century ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector. Experts here say this would be another turning point in the oil industry, since it would shield the country's crude from the blows of U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Ahvaz.
New communications director Guto Harry walking into the prime minister's office carrying a bag of groceries. Another new face, conservative MP Steve Barclay, now Boris Johnson's chief of staff, part of the prime minister's shake-up at number 10.
It's not actually driven by Boris. It's been driven by a faction that's trying to remove him. And the reason it's happening now is because we're at the mid-stage between general elections.
The new appointments come after five of the PM's most trusted Downing Street staff quit last week over Partygate allegations. And more changes are promised as he looks to turn the rising tide of letters of no confidence. Those letters follow allegations of parties held under the Prime Minister's roof during lockdown, when the rest of the people adhered to the strict social distancing guidelines. In total, 16 parties allegedly took place in 2 years of lockdowns. An inquiry conducted by civil servant Sue Gray, although published in its redacted form, only mentioned four of the parties, all of which pointed to a violation of the government's own rules. The other 12 are under investigation by the Metropolitan Police, who stepped in at the 11th hour, asking Sue Gray not to release her inquiry in full, buying the Prime Minister more time. Despite public outcry and the calls from members of his own party on him to resign, Boris Johnson and those closest to him say the country should move on from the scandal.
And this is an attempt actually to remove him, to put a Remainer or a globalist in charge for the next general election. That's what's really going on. I think Boris will stick the course and he'll probably be with us in 2024. And unless Labour finds someone better than Keir Starmer to stand against him in 2024, Boris is much more likely than Labour to win that general election in 2 years' time.
Yet other experts say that while he and his allies work in overdrive to shore up his future as Prime Minister, the fallout from the Sue Gray inquiry and the ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation hangs over Boris Johnson's head like a Damocles sword. Sait Pourreza, London.
Advocates and families of Palestinian prisoners have protested at the Red Cross office in the besieged Gaza Strip in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian inmates languishing inside Israeli jails. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are suffering from medical negligence.
Israel is practicing systematic medical negligence against Palestinian prisoners. Currently, more than 700 prisoners are suffering from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical care. Palestinian prisoners also must not be treated inside military hospitals.
Hundreds of Palestinians are also being held in Israeli jails without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Islamic Jihad movement slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
As we stand here, we affirm our support for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially those held under administrative detention. They have been refusing to attend courts for 38 days now, because administrative detention is illegal and is a crime against Palestinians.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights and continue to languish behind bars as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are prisoners of war, and they must be treated according to international law and norms. Because we are under occupation, Palestinian prisoners need international protection, and Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners also suffer from prolonged solitary confinement and inhumane detention conditions.
Latest figures by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran and Kashmir have a long history of cultural, linguistic and ethnic ties dating back to pre-Islamic period. The arrival of great Iranian religious missionaries in Kashmir, particularly in the 14th and 15th century, cemented this bond further. The overwhelming Iranian influence in Kashmir earned the Himalayan region the sobriquet of Iran-e-Saghir, or Little Iran. In February 1979, following the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Kashmir was among the first to wholeheartedly embrace it. They rejoiced at Iran's liberation from the clutches of the US-backed Pahlavi regime.
I remember when the news of triumph of Islamic Revolution reached here, people of all shades took to the streets in jubilation. Rallies and gatherings were held. Soon after the victory of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei visited Kashmir, followed by the other prominent revolutionary figures like Mahdavi Ghani and Golzadeh Ghafuri. The bond between Iran and Kashmir has only grown stronger over the years.
People were very minutely and very carefully watching Iran Revolution at that time. And for a few reasons, Kashmir has been, you know, historically connected with Iran and Central Asia. There was a propagation of Islam here and a lot of people converting to the faith of Islam as a result of Mir Sayyid Ali Hamdani. Hamdani brought economic pursuits like, say, binding industry, paper and binding industry at that time, 550 years back. And along with traditional handicrafts, which were, you know, flourishing at that time in Iran, he brought certain artisans, certain craftsmen, skilled people, and they came along with the propagation of faith.
Political observers and academics in this Muslim-majority region believe the Islamic Revolution's core message of Islamic unity and anti-imperialism struck a chord with people in Kashmir. They derived inspiration from it in their quest for freedom, justice and equality.
People of Kashmir saw it positively. They cooperated with it because there was already a prevailing atmosphere of Muslim unity in Kashmir those days. They joined the gatherings which were celebrated in connection with the celebration of Islamic Revolution and as a message for Islamic unity and the upliftment of the downtrodden peoples of the world.
As the world marks the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, people here in Kashmir take immense pride in being the advocates of this great movement that has championed the cause of Islamic revival and resistance against the arrogant powers of the world. Sayyid Ali Safi, Indian administered Kashmir.
Iranians celebrate the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution that transformed their country from a U.S. ally to a bitter opponent. Yemenis are still facing a deadly U.S.-backed war. This has urged Yemeni politicians to try to learn more about the Islamic Revolution and its stance against U.S. hegemony.
The region was about to fall prey to the American Zionist project, and the Arab regimes would have given up on the Palestinian cause, resulting in the further oppression of the Palestinians and the deterioration of the Arabs' dream of liberation from American hegemony. The Islamic Revolution turned Iran into the first country to be freed from U.S. dependence. It created a psychological balance among the people. As for the Arab puppet regimes, they feared the danger of the people and delayed their normalization with the Zionists. Today, Muslims are aware of U.S. dominating policies and find liberation necessary.
Yemeni politicians and scholars say the Islamic Revolution keeps on inspiring Yemeni people to stand against the U.S. and its supported forces in the region, just as they did on their September 21st revolution 8 years ago.
I still remember the outbreak of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. I was studying in secondary school and Arab people were constantly talking about it. We even wore t-shirts with the image of Imam Khomeini. But given the importance of this revolution, many Arab dictators started to ban the clothes that had the image of Imam Khomeini on them. And this is one of the first memories that they have of the Islamic Revolution. The Yemeni people have learned a lot from the Islamic Revolution in Iran. It encouraged them to stand against the colonial policies in their own country. And this also sparked their revolution of September 21st, 2014.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has always been a strong supporter of the Palestinian cause and has marked the International Quds Day. And now it is also standing beside the people of Yemen in the U.S.-backed Saudi led war against them.
Observers say all the free people of the world must look up to the Islamic Revolution of Iran and follow in the footsteps of its leaders in order to stand against the U.S. hegemony. They say the Islamic Revolution will remain a source of pride for all Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
While Iran is marking the anniversary of its 1979 revolution, which overthrew a U.S.-backed regime, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank hail it as the most successful revolution in the contemporary era. I met the former speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council, Dr. Hassan Khreshi. He praised the Iranian revolution as a source of inspiration in the region and beyond. After the 1979 revolution, Iran started supporting the Palestinians. It all began after Iranians took over the Israeli embassy in Tehran and handed it over to the Palestine Liberation Organization. As part of its effort to inspire the oppressed people, Iran aided emerging Palestinian resistance groups, notably the movements of Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Both the Palestinian factions sent their representatives to Tehran, while Iran's support for both groups continue until today. Iran's Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments. To Palestinians, the revolution anniversary is reminiscent of their struggle for independence and resistance against the Israeli atrocities. Iran's Islamic Revolution is viewed today as a potent, unstoppable force in the region and beyond. An example in this regard is the heroic struggles of the Palestinian people against Israel. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
U.S. police violence targeting black people has once again brought Americans to the streets in the northern city of Minneapolis, which is still reeling from the police murder of George Floyd, a black man, in 2020. This time, the victim is Amir Locke, a 22-year-old African-American who was killed when police stormed into his apartment without warning on Wednesday. Hundreds of protesters rallied in the city calling for the arrest of officers involved in the shooting and an end to discriminatory law enforcement tactics. Similar protests were held in New York City. The officers were carrying out a no-knock search warrant on the apartment. The city's mayor has now announced a suspension of no-knock warrants that have been at the center of heated debates over rising police violence. Back in 2020, the city restricted the use of such unannounced raids as part of a series of reforms that were introduced following mass anti-racism protests.
They barge in before they ever identify themselves, and they give Amir no time to save his own life. And that's something that we don't see white citizens encounter. And the fact that it's happening in Minneapolis again is beyond tragic. It's abhorrent.
Locke's parents say their son was a beloved member of his community and a law-abiding citizen.
I believe that he was executed by the MPD, and I want the police officer that murdered my son to be prosecuted and fired.
Locke's death has reopened the wounds caused by the murder of Floyd and a dozen of other recent victims. Official figures show that black men are three times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. But police bullets, batons, or knees are not the only concerns to African Americans. The deep-rooted anti-black racism also shows itself in inadequate access to health care, food, housing, and jobs. In 2020, the injustices long felt by African Americans triggered a nationwide protest movement challenging police brutality and bias in the U.S. criminal justice system. And that movement transformed into a global campaign to fight racism and build a world free of discrimination and supremacist ideologies.
Israel once again at the heart of an international rift and controversy, this time within a usually united body valuing consensus, the African Union. A row so fierce that the bloc was forced to suspend a debate on whether to rescind Israel's observer status and postpone a potentially divisive vote. The rare dispute within the 55-member body was set in motion last July. That's when Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, unilaterally accepted Israel's accreditation to the bloc. A slew of criticism followed. Powerful members, including South Africa and Algeria, were among the many protesting that the decision had been taken without consultations. They also argued that the decision flew in the face of African Union statements supporting the Palestinian territories. The AU has called for an end to the Israeli occupation and an independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. Israel received AU observer status after 20 years of diplomatic efforts. The quest is largely seen as part of the regime's US-backed campaign to normalize ties with African and Arab countries such as Morocco, Sudan, the UAE and Bahrain. But analysts believe the normalization does not enjoy popular support.
Of course, Israel has hitherto been, of course, unaccepted in Asia or in West Asia. And although you've got clandestinely nations like Saudi Arabia who have been dealing with it, and others more overtly like Jordan and Egypt, etc., you've nonetheless got this kind of fear amongst leaderships in West Asia, even now, of openly becoming part of the Israeli syndicate, because the people, ultimately at the grassroots, certainly the Arab people, are not happy with the idea of Israel being accepted.
Palestine gained observer status at the African Union in 2013. Its Prime Minister, Mohamed Shtayyeh, addressed the bloc's latest summit held at the weekend. He called for Israel's accreditation to be revoked.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion. This must stop.
Resistance movement Hamas has also slammed granting Israel the observer status. Hamas says the move is a flagrant violation of the principles and statute of the African Union, which reject racism and demand decolonization and the right to self-determination. The African body has now set up a six-country committee to review Israel's observer status and submit its findings during an assembly next year, a decision that will ultimately come down to whether or not the bloc will stick to its anti-colonial and anti-racist principles.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, dini, wal-Azam, ghayru dini, Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
We are talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, you know, We see it on and off in today's world that some of the cities, in fact, are getting reshaped by the city hall, the municipality. There are some civil rules that need to be, in fact, applied to different parts of the town or city.